agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how you doing?
Well, it's cold and windy, and it's early in the morning, and I'm up to argue with my old college buddy over politics for the amusement of strangers.
There you go.
So you tell me.
Yeah, well, that's well, I always enjoy doing it, certainly. And you know,
I do. Actually, I've been off a couple of weeks, and I welcome the breaks, but I miss you when I'm not on.
I feel the same way for sure. You know, before we do get started, I just wanted to give folks a quick sort of update on Trey. Trey, as folks know, Trey's been off the show for a little bit, dealing with some health issues, and he's been very open about that. Things are really rough for Trey right now, not just with the health issues, which are just about as bad as I've seen in these last couple of years. He's been dealing with this, but also he's dealing with a very recalcitrant insurance company that is at this point refusing to provide coverage for treatment that he desperately needs. It's a infuriating situation, and Trey is handling it with his usual grace and to the extent he can, good spirits. And what we want to, you know, do what we can certainly to help him out during this really stressful time. And so what we're going to do is, anyone who sends in anything to the show for the rest of the year here, we're going to have that go directly to Trey, whether that's your Patreon supporter and you do it through Patreon, changing your level, or through our Venmo, we're at Politics Guys, or PayPal. And we always, you know, have those links in the show notes, and it's patreon.com/politicsguys and politicsguys.com/support, I think. We just want to do something also, because so many times over the last few years, Trey has been sick and in pain and done the show anyway, and you would never know it. And so this is something that I feel like he very much deserves. And so if you want to help out, that would be great. Certainly, well, we would appreciate it. If not, you know, Trey would certainly appreciate thoughts and prayers as well. And Trey, if you're listening, buddy, hang in there. And we really hope that you're going to be back full strength sometime very soon, early next year. All right. So before we get going, we have a lot to talk about. We have the Trump special master decision, a rail strike legislation, an agreement that was imposed. The Supreme Court taking on the Biden student loan forgiveness case and the Oath Keepers sedition conviction, and maybe even some more stuff. Obviously, there's a whole lot, and we will get to that in just one second. All right, Jay. So this week, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals vacated District Judge Eileen Cannon's order appointing a special master to review classified documents that were seized from Trump's Mar-a-Lago home and office on August 8th of this year. And in that unanimous unsigned ruling, the three-judge panel, I should point out, all Republican appointees and two of the three appointed by Donald Trump himself, the panel was, I would say, clearly critical of Judge Cannon's order. They wrote that Cannon improperly exercised equitable discretion in even hearing the case in the first place. Now, the 11th Circuit acknowledged the unusual nature of the raid, writing, "It's indeed extraordinary for a warrant to be executed at the home of a former president, but not in a way that affects our legal analysis or otherwise gives judiciary license to interfere in an ongoing investigation. And that to create a special exception here would defy our nation's foundational principle that our law applies to all without regard to numbers, wealth, or rank." And the opinion concluded, "The law is clear. We cannot write a rule that allows any subject of a search warrant to block government investigations after the execution of the warrant. Nor can we write a rule that allows only former presidents to do so. Either approach would be a radical reordering of our case law limiting the federal court's involvement in criminal investigations, and both would violate bedrock separation of powers limitations. So there we go. You know, when we talked about this in the past, this Cannon's order, my position has been that, well, a special master might have made political sense, might have been the sort of thing that the Department of Justice could have asked for in a way, but that Judge Cannon, in my view, didn't really have the authority to intervene and require one. And I think you were a little less convinced of this and argued that kind of what you saw as a record of bad behavior by the FBI maybe put Cannon's ruling on more solid ground. And so I wanted to get your take on this decision, which was, I mean, it seemed to me a pretty clear smackdown here of Cannon.
Yeah. So I'm still of the position, and you're going to think this is contradictory, but that Judge Cannon did the right thing and that the Court of Appeals did the right thing.
I do want to hear that because that confuses me.
Because I think we did talk a bit in the past about the idea about bells that can't be unrung. And I think if you were the trial court judge and you're confronted with this motion and you deny it, right? And there may be significant issues relating to the investigation for president of equitable power. I still think there's a good argument for equity given the circumstances. But setting that aside, the bigger point is, as I've said before, the job of the district court is to preserve issues, important issues of law for review for the Court of Appeals. And that's what happened. The Court of Appeals has ruled. Now we've got a clear direction on this, and we're going to go back to where we were sort of before Trump appointed the special master. And I think you and I are both on the same page that regardless, this whole special master thing was going to be sort of a speed bump at best. And I think that's what it's been.
Do you think there's a distinction though to be made between a district court's judge ruling that maybe errs on the side of preserving the status quo or like you said, not ringing bells that shouldn't be unrung, or you get the idea, but or things that it seems like that the circuit court suggested were just like way wrong. I mean, there are certain things, right, that judges should not be doing. And it seems like this wasn't just the appeals court saying, you know what, she erred in judge. It was kind of like it was a close thing and she sort of went the wrong way here. It was like, no, this was just like violates bedrock separation of powers limitation sort of thing. And I mean, that's not just like she got it a little bit wrong. This is like, wow, this was horribly bad.
No, but we talked about this before. When the standard for when something goes up on appeal, you have what's called sort of the standard of review. That what is the appellate court supposed to look at? What extent do we review what the trial court did? And on certain issues, there are issues about, okay, did the court err as a matter of law, in which point the court reviews de novo. There are meaning from the start, right? From with fresh eyes, they don't give any deference to the trial court. And then there are issues that are subject to what's called abuse of discretion review. Now, abuse of discretion review is a much higher standard. And to abuse your discretion, it's not easy to abuse your discretion accidentally. And abuse of discretion cases are not those ones of like reviewing court says, well, close call, could have gone either way. We might have done something different. That would not be abuse of discretion. So necessarily, right, that it went before the court on this abuse of discretion. They said, listen, she did abuse her discretion in finding that there was equitable jurisdiction over this issue. I wouldn't say that. I don't want to say that implies bad faith or something like that. But it is. It's a big error, if you will.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, to some extent, I think if you're not a lawyer reading that opinion, it's going to read as harsher than if you are a lawyer, knowing that the whole case is about abuse of discretion anyway, and you know that's. So, I'm not sure that added a whole lot.
Okay.
The discussion, but I'm.
I think there's
sometimes a tendency where you say, "Oh wow, the Court of Appeals smacked down somebody," and I just in my experience, typically that's not the way it works. Like it's you know, damn, you know what I mean? It's
well, but I mean
they're using the language that it's.
But I mean, you said that before, but I mean, it's not like in the decision they're going to say the Judge Cannon was an incompetent hack who did right. I mean, that's not what they're going to say, and so
well that would be a smack.
That would be it. So, but I mean, I think it seems like this is about
what I'm saying is there are courts that say the trial court abused its discretion all the time,
right?
Right. So I guess that's the point I'm trying to make.
Right, but I mean this was I mean I read this, you know, I read that you've obviously read a lot more opinions than I have, you know, but it sure seemed to me that this wasn't just like, oh whoops kind of thing. I mean the language in here was
because if it wasn't a whoops thing, they wouldn't have cause to overturn it.
So you're saying basically that this is just like a kind of a normal everyday sort of thing and not a big deal.
Or I wouldn't say every day.
Gotcha.
But certainly once every couple weeks, once a month, maybe. I mean, you know what I mean? It's one of those kind of, I mean, a lot of, you know, cases come up on abuse of discretion, and I would say in probably a good 80% of abuse of discretion cases, the Court of Appeals says, look, we don't find an abuse because that's a high bar to get over. But in this case, they did.
And Judge Cannon faulted it easily. So there you go. All right. Okay. Yeah. And so do you agree? I don't know if I really actually asked you that question point blank. Do you agree with the appeals court's ruling here?
I think so. Yeah. Okay. Again, would I have, you know, it's always a little difficult to say, do I agree with a specific court on a specific case? If I haven't like, you know,
sure. I mean, based down, on it's always going to be based on what you know. Arguments. Yeah. Yeah. Of yeah. course. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was still leaning towards the, I think you, in cases of where there was potential privilege involved, you err on the side of caution. And again, it's because it's sort of a no harm, no foul type resolution, right?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, if it delays an investigation and it allows people to maybe move evidence or do stuff. I mean, so it's not necessarily no harm, no foul.
But, yeah.
And also there's the question of the harm to the order of, you know, separation of powers and judicial activism and that sort of thing and setting precedents and slippery slopes and all that kind of stuff. So,
I would argue that sort of argues in my favor. It's because it's not setting precedents, right? That's kind of the whole idea.
But isn't it setting a precedent for judicial interference?
But the precedent is set by the Court of Appeals.
Right? I see what you're saying. Okay, sure.
You know, no one is going to be able to go and rely on Judge Cannon's order,
right,
to say, aha, you know, I'm entitled to a special master under these circumstances.
Gotcha.
Now, arguably, I suppose you could have tried to rely on that during the couple months when it was pending before the Court of Appeals and before the Court of Appeals ruled.
Right.
But what I'm saying is kind of an institutionalist argument that you're better off if she had ruled the other way. The Court of Appeals would never have had the opportunity to rule. Now that there is a recorded published opinion from the Court of Appeals, you know, we've got solid law, and that's better for everybody.
Gotcha.
If you follow me.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I do. And my sense of things is that this basically has no chance of being overturned on appeal. I don't even think the Supreme Court would probably hear it, but what's your take on that?
Agreed. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure that, so I think what would happen, right? the Trump, and I haven't seen this ad. I don't know that it's happened yet. I haven't read the news yet this morning, but I suppose it could have. But Trump will seek an emergency injunction from the Supreme Court on the shadow docket.
There you go. I know you like saying that.
I think that will be, you'll have a simple denial on it.
And so, you know, these investigations that were kind of the underlying thing here were recently turned over to that special counsel, Jack Smith. I mean, I wanted to get, we haven't had a chance really to talk about that, and we won't get into that in any detail, but well, what's your sense of maybe the timeline here? Because the whole thing about, a big thing about the special master, former Attorney General Barr talked about it as a rain delay, and now that delay is being removed. Do you have a sense in your mind of maybe how long it might be until we see, and I'm guessing there's going to be at least one or maybe more indictments out of this, and how long that process might take? Do you have just kind of a general sense of that? I mean, obviously we're talking, you know, not months, but I mean more than months, but what do you think?
Yeah. None whatsoever, really. Other than I will say, and I don't want to ascribe any bad motives to the appointed special counsel. But I think this is a fact of special counsels. It's not independent counsel. It is special.
Yeah, we don't have a special.
So I misspoke. So this is a fault in the system. It's a fault in human nature. If you got a job you like that you're getting paid for, nobody really wants that job to end. I don't mean to ascribe anything against him. I think it's human nature that you're going to want to take your time and do your best, keep the thing going for a while. Now, depending on what indictments might come down and might be out. So if this is indictments about the Mar-a-Lago papers, I would think there's probably not a whole lot left to investigate. To the extent it ranges wider, and I don't know how wide it could range, right? That could take longer. So it wouldn't surprise me to see some indictments early. And again, this is a little bit of a weird situation. And oftentimes, if you've got one of these big investigations, well, you have a whole lot of indictments. And what you do is you get the smaller fish and have them flip on the bigger fish. But to me, this looks like there's just one fish. I'm not sure if it's a, you know, I suppose there are people who might be somehow subject to.
Well, I think people.
I'm not sure who else would be subject to indictment, right? Who do you?
I think people who he directed. I mean, people who Donald Trump directed to do certain things with documents and that sort of thing, and they could testify as to what Trump told them to do and that sort of thing.
But I'm saying they would be witnesses; they wouldn't be defendants.
I see what you're saying. Sure. Yeah.
Because I'm not sure. I mean, maybe there could be a crime, right? I mean, if Donald Trump talks to whoever and says, "Hey, I've got these super top secret documents that I'm not supposed to have. I want you to help me keep them out of the hands of the National Archives,
right?
And the FBI." Well, yeah, I think then you could have an obstruction of justice case against that person.
Yeah.
Or the old, we went to interview this person and he lied to the FBI, so he obstructed justice there. You could have that kind of case,
right?
But it's not sort of a Nixonian. Web of all these people where you have flip on one another.
That's more the other thing that Smith is investigating, not just January 6th, but the whole kind of attempts to overturn the outcome of the election kind of thing, which is much more serious.
And that might bear, again, more fruit in having downstream defendants who you could flip. You might have some criminal liability. But what I'm saying is I don't, on the face of it, I wouldn't see any criminal liability to the guy from the moving company.
Right.
Or Trump says, "Hey, put him in the basement or whatever, put him on the pool table."
Sure. All right. Well, we will see. There will definitely be more to come on that for certain, I would say. All right. Moving on then, late this week, large bipartisan majorities in both the House and the Senate acted to avert a nationwide freight rail worker strike by passing legislation that imposes an agreement on the rail workers and employers. Now, the agreement gives workers a 24% pay increase over 5 years, retroactive to 2020. They'll also be receiving one additional paid day off and the right to go to medical appointments without a penalty, but they'll still be required to use unpaid time off to go to those appointments. And one big thing that the agreement didn't require, and this is kind of the big sticking point, was paid sick leave. There was a proposal for 7 days of paid leave that narrowly passed the House, 221 to 207, with just 3 Republicans voting for it, but it failed to get the 60 votes necessary to overcome a filibuster in the Senate. So interestingly, 6 Republicans actually supported the measure, and it's kind of a weird cast. Braun, Cruz, Graham, Hawley, Kennedy, and Rubio. Very strange. Anyway, and after the vote, I believe it was Bernie Sanders called out to, I think it was Ted Cruz, saying, "I always knew you were a socialist." So interesting. So anyway, Joe Manchin was the only Democrat who opposed the week of paid sick leave. So that's the agreement. Jay, I guess before we get to the details of the agreement, what you think about it in general, what do you think about Congress imposing an agreement on workers and their employers?
Well, as you can guess, I'm not crazy about those kind of solutions. But I would say this is one of those circumstances where Congress does have the power to impose these kind of solutions. I mean, it's you know, in statute.
The Railway Labor Act of 1926.
Yeah. So, because you know, to preserve sort of these essential infrastructure, kind of things. So I look, it's unfortunate that, it's come to that, but I think that is the better situation, overall. So,
because, I mean, when you talk about the potential ramifications to interstate commerce, and that's how Congress derives that authority, their ability to regulate interstate commerce under Article 1, Section 8, that freight rail moves something like a third of all exports, 40% of all long-distance freight, and it was estimated that a work stoppage by the workers could cost something like up to $2 billion every single day. So that is a significant impairment of interstate commerce, for sure. This is the 18th time that Congress has actually intervened in this way. Now, though it's been a while, the last time was 1994, so over a quarter century ago. And this all started, of course, I believe the workers have been without a contract since 2020, and that's why the retroactive pay thing. And they tried to work it out, and they weren't able to get together. Then this summer, President Biden appointed an arbitrator board to kind of help them work things out. That didn't happen. The unions wanted a 31% raise in paid sick days, and the railroads were offering 17%. And then the board that Biden appointed suggested 24%, which is actually what they ended up deciding on there, being mandated to. What do you think about that? That kind of forced agreement. Do you think that was a fair kind of way to go about it?
Well, it's less a question of fair and more, if that's what Congress voted, that's what that's what it is, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a political negotiation. And that's where the votes were to get that sort of resolution. Now, that resolution, of course, is pretty close to what the compromise that the Biden administration had brokered earlier. So it makes sort of sense to say, and this isn't the end of the story either. I mean, it's not like this will be permanent. I think what will happen is the sides will go back to the table and they will work something out. But in the interim, the trains keep running. So I think it's the process is as good as it can be, right?
I think from the railway workers' perspective, they feel, at least a lot of them feel, that basically It's a situation where the federal government is kind of backstopping the rail, the owners, because of that, then the owners don't necessarily have to negotiate in good faith, because they know that in the end, if they come to a stalemate, they kind of get bailed out. And what the railway workers will point out, and rightly so, was that the rail transportation industry has one of the highest net margins of any industry. It's around 28.9% based on the most recent data from at least from NYU's Stern School of Business. And to give you a sense, the average industry net margin is 8.83%, and only software and financial services have higher net profit margins. So I can understand certainly the railway workers saying, hey, where's our cut? And if there wasn't this federal backstopping to kind of force us to do this, then we would have more leverage in these negotiations. And I think that's a fair point.
Yeah, that is a fair point. Also, I mean, consider part of this is the rail system is a government sanctioned oligopoly.
Yep.
Right. And it always kind of has been. And to some extent, the argument would be some of these companies made the investments in this rail system for the benefit of the country years ago. They pay for the ongoing maintenance of it, and therefore are entitled to some higher return. It's much like a utility. Now again, I have a lot of feelings about government-sanctioned monopolies, sure, or oligopolies. Not positive generally. But I also recognize that is kind of the situation we're in. It's not as if you can have a lot of new entrants into the market who are just going to be, I'm going to build a railway between this city and that city.
Then it becomes a question of what a fair rate of return is. And I think a lot of folks would say, well, very top of all industries maybe is a little too generous when we're talking about that.
And it may be. Yeah. You can dig into the arguments on the merits of that. But also a lot of people would say a 24% pay increase is pretty generous.
Of course, that depends on what the base is and increase. So there are a lot of factors out. But just other things being equal, most people would say 24% over 5 years sounds pretty good.
Yeah. And I would also point out, you know, there's been a lot of argument about, rail workers don't get any paid sick leave, but they do. And I'm looking at this is from the AAR.org. Depending on what you do, you have up to 4 personal days, depending on seniority. And if you're an operating craft road job, you have up to 12 personal days. Now, a lot of companies don't give you sick days and personal days. It's one or the other. And the argument is often that personal days are even better and more flexible in that you don't have to say you were sick. You don't have to have some sort of doctor excuse.
But we're not talking about paid here. Right. I mean, we're talking about just.
No, this is paid.
I'm off. Okay.
Yeah.
I think.
And then you would have the option, you could take unpaid sick leave. But what I'm saying is there's just to the extent that the argument has been made, what happens if somebody gets sick, they can't have any paid time off. That's not entirely accurate.
Right. Absolutely.
It's just called something else. It's called personal time rather than
sick time. There are also provisions for short-term disability and things like that. But I think, you know, a lot of folks who are familiar with, say, employer and worker relations in other large, rich countries around the world that are not the United States look at the United States and say, wow, what a stingy, horrible system that seems to screw over workers when we compare it to, I don't know, so many other countries. And so when you look at international context, certainly the United States tends to, if you're a worker, trail in terms of what is provided to workers.
I'm not arguing with you.
There you go. Okay. Let's move on to, back to the Supreme Court, I guess. The Supreme Court this week agreed to hear an expedited appeal from the Biden administration on President Biden's student loan forgiveness order. Now, the court set arguments for February, which is pretty quick by the court standards, and they denied the administration's request to lift the injunction blocking the program, and that injunction was imposed by the Eighth Circuit. Now, just to remind folks, the loan forgiveness program would forgive up to $20,000 in debt for millions of student loan borrowers at an estimated cost of around $400 billion, according to the CBO. Now, the Biden administration says it has the authority to do this under the HEROES Act of 2003, which gives the Secretary of Education the power to reduce or eliminate student loan obligations under certain circumstances. And six states brought suit, Nebraska, Missouri, Arkansas, Iowa, Kansas, and South Carolina. They allege that the action that Biden took contravenes the separation of powers and is arbitrary and capricious. We love this phrase on the show, in violation of the Administrative Procedures Act as well. Now, the district court from which the Eighth Circuit heard the appeal, they said the states bringing the suit didn't have standing because they couldn't demonstrate any concrete harm that might come to them. And so the three-judge panel from the Eighth Circuit, two Trump appointees and one George W. Bush appointee, they disagreed. They said Missouri's argument that their state-created agency that gets some money by servicing student loans, they could potentially suffer concrete harm if there's this mass debt forgiveness. And so now when the district court found that the states didn't have standing, it just stopped there because that's the first thing you need to determine. But once the Eighth Circuit decided there was sufficient standing, it then needed to consider whether or not to enjoin the program, which required, in their words, balancing of the equities and the probability of success on the merits. And the Eighth Circuit concluded that the loss that would be suffered would be irreversible, as opposed to the lack of harm if the status quo of no relief is maintained. And, you know, one thing I noticed in the Eighth Circuit's opinion is that they really didn't address the likelihood of success on the merits. They only wrote that the case involves substantial questions of law which remain to be resolved. Jay, so what do you think about the Eighth Circuit's opinion here and what we might see at the Supreme Court?
So I think that's the right course, and that's kind of consistent with what we just talked about earlier, is the Eighth Circuit is teeing it up for the Supreme Court to decide this significant question of presidential power. So I think that's appropriate. The determination on whether the loan servicing organization MOHELA has standing, the Eighth Circuit said yes. It certainly looks like they did, or they do, or that's likely to. And again, for weighing the immediacy of harms, there would seem to be an immediate harm because there's an immediate harm anytime anytime the Constitution is violated, really. So. That's how you get your immediacy. Whereas maintaining the status quo, is not really going to hurt anyone until we get to the, you know, let the Supreme Court decide this issue. So,
just a clarification on that. There's the distinction, right, between the Constitution can be violated by something all the time, but if no one can show that they're actually sure. In some substantive particular way harmed, then right. That can just keep on going on forever and the courts just can't intervene in that.
Right. Yeah. Right. No, exactly. Okay. But what the Eighth Circuit said is it looks like MOHELA is suffering that sort of constitutional damage.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was kind of hoping you'd say MOHELA because it's a fun thing to say. And I thought you'd kind of like
to
say
it. I do like saying
it's like last week, you know, Kristen and I were talking about Chewbacca and, you know, I thought of you.
Did you make this noise?
No, I didn't make the noise, but anyway. So,
I wanted to have a train whistle for our last story, but I didn't.
That would have been nice. Yeah, definitely. So. Anyway, you know, I read the HEROES Act just a few days ago, and it's very, very clear to me that the HEROES Act was not intended to be used this way. If you just open it up,
and you are a hero, Mike.
You know, there you go. I mean that literally.
The military,
If you read the bill's findings, this part at the beginning where it says basically it explains the purpose of this legislation. All of the references are exclusively concerning people serving in the military. That was the whole point. This is during folks who were like reservists or active duty people who had this student debt, and they had to be taken out of their lives to go serve in Iraq or Afghanistan. The thinking was, we want to help them out, basically. And so there was no sense. Nobody in Congress thought that this would be some kind of a vehicle for mass student loan forgiveness. But that said, there is a provision of the act that allows for waiving student loan debt for anyone who suffered, in the words, suffered direct economic hardship as a direct result of a war or other military operation, here we go, or national emergency. And so this is a case where I think you could argue that the Biden administration is within the exact letter of the law, but very clearly operating well outside of the intent of the law. At least that's my read of it.
Oh, yeah. And I would say not only I think there's a good argument of outside the letter in terms of can the president unilaterally it kind of starts going into like, you know, major questions type issues, but can Congress or non-delegation, even can Congress simply assign the power to the president to unilaterally waive all of these loans? And look, there's nothing like this that has anything, you know, ever happened before. This is a sort of literally unprecedented, sweep, you know, one stroke of the pen, making policy that way. So I think on the merits, you know, when we get to the merits, I think the states have a very, very strong claim that this is something that's just simply well outside the power of the president, or even outside of the power of Congress to assign to the president. So that's, you know, on the merits, I think there's a strong case that he can't do this. And not surprisingly, like, you know, look, he seemed to acknowledge this, he being President Biden, earlier, and congressional leaders have acknowledged this. And the game, as it were, is just sort of, okay, we'll do it. And it's just a matter of who's going to have standing to try to contest it.
Yeah.
And that's really what, you know, the whole issue has been about, is who can come up with a theory of standing. And it looks like at this point, Mohila may have cracked the code.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I guess on one hand, you can say, well, geez, maybe Congress should write better legislation, because they certainly could have put in a provision saying that this only applies to military or former military or something like that, which was their intent, but it wasn't the legislative language. And so I could see someone saying, hey, Congress, you know, shape up. If you want to specify this, you should specify this. But with the there is a national emergency, and you gave the Secretary of Education, the authority to waive these things under a national emergency. And maybe you should just, you know, clean up your act and say what you mean, not just in the findings, but in the actual legislative language. And I'm actually, while I agree with you in general that this is an abuse of presidential power, I also think that Congress oftentimes writes some pretty bad legislation, and they need to do a better job of it.
Maybe, but I don't know if you can task Congress with predicting all potential uses or abuses of a statute.
Yeah, but in this case, when they're talking about
sort of reasonable,
but in this case, I mean, it was clearly intended to focus on military members, and yet in the language of the legislation, they didn't drop a single qualifying conditional about who qualifies. Just people, anyone, essentially. Yeah. So,
could you envision though? But I mean, Congress, I understand that. I think you're right to a point. The Congress also shouldn't have to write laws to the extent that, and what we mean by this is, no, you can't use this to unilaterally cancel student debt for everybody across the country, 30 years later, 20 years later. So that's.
Yeah, I know. I see what you're saying. Right? But I think it's better from Congress. I think it's better from a general standpoint, to have Congress specify limits, then to just sort of see what happens and how the president feels that day and what the courts might happen to want to decide. You know, I think it's much better for Congress just to say, here are the limits.
And I think there's a problem there because I think there is very much an issue in a lot of times. I mean, I saw this in my experience in the state of Ohio. If there are questions that you don't want to address or can't address or can't resolve, and you're trying to get the bill done, trying to get a compromise, the decision is often as well, we'll let the courts figure that out.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
You come to an impasse and say, look, if that ever happens, that'll be a question for the court. So, and maybe there were those conversations in Congress about, well, suppose the president 20 years from now tries to use this to cancel all student debt or forgive a large portion of student debt. Should we address that? And I think, members of Congress might have said, oh, come on. That's
who'd do that? Yeah, exactly.
Two,
sure. Yeah.
And two, if it does, well, we'll take it up with the courts then.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
So no, I would give, look, I'd give a Congress a C+, right? On the draft.
Yeah, that seems reasonable. Yeah. Well, I'd give him a D.
Yeah, I suppose. But, okay. but I think it's unfair to have the legislature be fortune tellers that they can see any potential abuse of the
sure.
statute.
Yeah. I think you're right to a point as well. So there we go. We are both right to a point. I think we can agree on that. So I think in the end that the court is going to see it the Eighth Circuit's way. I think they're going to find that President that this won't go forward. I don't know the exact reasoning they will use, but this pretty clearly seems to me to be problematic, whether it's the president abusing his discretion or Congress not really having the authority to give this amount of discretion to the president. Either way, I do not think that the student loan debt relief thing is going to stand. That's my prediction.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. Yes.
All right. Okay.
Although, I'm curious. I'm wondering if the court might wait and consolidate it with some of the other student debt cases that are coming up.
There was one, I think, from the Fifth Circuit. I wanted, or maybe the 11th. Or 11th, I'm one of them anyway. So, but yeah,
one just filed in Ohio yesterday, Mike.
Yes, there we go.
That's just a little hint for you.
Okay.
Northern District, Southern District of Ohio.
My area. There we go. All right. So let's keep with the judicial sort of thing, but something very different judicially. This week, a federal jury in Washington, D.C. found Oath Keepers leader Stuart Rhodes guilty of seditious conspiracy for his role in plotting to keep Donald Trump in power after Trump had lost the 2020 presidential election. Now, Rhodes was one of five defendants accused of seditious conspiracy and a number of other charges. Kelly Meggs, who ran the Florida chapter of the Oath Keepers, was also found guilty on that charge, with three other Oath Keepers found not guilty of seditious conspiracy, but guilty of various other things. Now, this is the first successful sedition prosecution in over a quarter century. The last was in 1995 about some Islamic militants. They were found guilty of plotting to bomb some monuments, some landmarks in New York City. Now, there have been, though I should point out, four seditious conspiracy guilty pleas already in the current capital breach, which is the term Department of Justice is using, so I thought we'd go with that. Three from Oath Keepers and one from a Proud Boys leader. Now, according to the latest information from the Department of Justice, which has a kind of a resource site about the Capitol breach, there have been over 900 arrests made in conjunction with these investigations, with just over half of those arrested pleading guilty, 110 have pleaded guilty to felonies, and 337 to misdemeanors. So, Jay, I thought we'd start with these recent jury verdicts and kind of move on maybe more generally to thoughts on how the criminal investigations are going kind of more broadly almost 2 years after that Capitol breach. So what do you think about the seditious conspiracy conviction?
Based on what I know, it sounds like the jury had the evidence to reach that conclusion, and they did. So, that's how the system's supposed to work. I think it's important that people who were involved in actually seeking to if not overthrow the government, you know, thwart its proper processes, intentionally. I think it's important that those people should answer for their crimes, and I think it's important that there's the distinctions be made between those folks and some of the you know, for lack of a better word, idiots who just showed up and then wandered into the Capitol after the gates were breached. So I think that's appropriate.
You know, I wanted to ask, because I certainly agree. I wanted to ask you, though, when we talked about this previously, my recollection was that in part that you were arguing that the possibility of success matters here. I mean, I think I recall making a bank robbery analogy. You said, you know, if you go into a bank, try to rob it with a Nerf gun, basically, you're still committing a crime. But I think you saw things a little bit differently, saying that maybe there shouldn't be an indictment or a conviction if there's no possibility of success. Is that, I don't want to.
Yeah. Yes. And no, I think a lot of that, I think we were talking in the context then of, you know, Trump planning a coup, right? Was this a Trumpian, you know, overthrow of the government that he had planned, that, you know, he had this plan with Mike Pence, would reject the electors and therefore, you know, they would, you know, yeah, make him president. And that, to my sense, would just be it's a legal impossibility. Right. But if the crime is, listen, you are trying to do this and commit an act of violence.
So you mean like we're arranging for transport of weapons across the Potomac, yeah, and we have people in place and we're set that kind of thing. It's much more of a real, yeah. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. As opposed to I think the claim was, look, if Trump says to Mike Pence, hey, I want you to, not recognize the electors from these states, and that could well be, I don't think that in and of itself, again, assuming he's got a reasonable belief to do so or something, right?
Right.
I don't think in itself rises to sedition.
Because in that sense, you can argue that, and I think Donald Trump would argue this, that he felt that was actually within Mike Pence's authority, whereas if he said
we got this statute from 1876 that says, you know, you can
and I think
that,
it means that. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. The lawyers have told me that this is, you know, so I think you can do that. Now everybody's wrong on that, except Mike Pence. But yeah, that in and of itself, I don't think is sedition. Yeah. Planning up, you know, coming up with a plan how you can contest the election isn't sedition. Coming up with a plan of how you storm the Capitol is.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess that's maybe the easy way to make the distinction.
And, you know, this is, I believe, the first time that any January 6th defendant has been actually acquitted of any charge in a jury trial. There were, in this case, with these five, there were 28 total charges against the five defendants, and the defendants and the jury acquitted them on 11 of those charges. And prior to this, jury trials, the Department of Justice was 65 of 67. Their jury was hung on two other charges. Now, when we look at bench trials, defendants have done slightly better. They've been acquitted on 10 out of a total of 70 charges where it went to bench trials, although all of those acquittals came from a single judge who Trump nominated to the D.C. Circuit in 2017, I believe it was. So is that a pretty good win-loss record? I guess I would think that probably they, what do you think about that?
It's going to vary between defendant and the charges that are brought on each, right? It's all going to kind of turn on the facts. And there are likely some defendants who are overcharged and maybe there are some that are undercharged, although the government usually doesn't undercharge. Does it surprise me? But there also could be, you know, when you say acquittal, there are times when the government may have multiple charges that they're bringing against a defendant, they may know that some of those charges are much less likely to stick than others. But if the defendant demands it goes to trial, then all the charges go to trial. Weak ones along with the strong ones. So I guess what I would look for is to what extent do you have defendants who were completely acquitted, right, of all charges?
Sure.
And I don't know the numbers on that. I suppose there are probably a couple.
I don't think there's been actually, I don't know if there's been, well, there might have been a few, but like I said, of all the, well, I mean, there's a distinction between people who have accepted plea deals and people
who have. I'm talking only, verdicts.
Yeah, and in terms of verdicts,
verdicts or bench decisions. Yeah,
in terms of verdicts, like I said, there was DOJ's 65 of 67 for all the charges with
that's pretty good.
And two hung juries, the jury being hung on two charges and
charges.
Charges. So that's, I think that's to me that suggests that the Department of Justice is being very careful about what it charges. They want to make really, really sure that they have convictions if they're actually going to go to trial.
I think that's probably right. But I'd also say, listen, the Department of Justice tends to win a lot. I'm not suggesting there's anything nefarious about that. It in fact probably does reflect the way that one gets into the criminal process, right? It's not a civil lawsuit where you can just say, "Hey, I'm gonna sue this guy," and then we'll work it all out. I mean, there's got to be an investigation. There's got to be probable cause. In many cases, a grand jury, and then followed up by investigation and a trial. So, yeah, and also just because government in the criminal prosecution has the extremely high burden of proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. They would tend to be more choosy about the cases that they bring.
Sure, that makes sense. Now, if we kind of pull back and look at things, how they're going overall, I mean, there are a number of ways to look at this. One thing, you know, recently Donald Trump has talked about his support for all of these people, or many of these people being charged. You know, he said that if he's reelected, he'd issue full pardons with an apology to many, and that he claimed to be financially supporting some of the defendants, although that he's not really been clear at exactly how he's doing. Donald Trump has made claims about financially supporting a lot of things, and it's not been the case. But what do you think about that aspect of it first, about Trump saying these things? If I'm president, we're going to get, you know, pardons and apologies and all that. What's your sense of that?
I think it's inappropriate to be going around pledging pardons for people. I don't think there's anything. If you're asking, does that look to be some sort of obstruction of justice type case? I don't think so. I think you could make that obstruction of justice case if it's something of the, closer to President Trump. And if this guy doesn't testify against me and gets convicted, and then don't keep your mouth shut and I'll party in later or something. Well, that you could argue that might be fall into an obstruction of justice type situation. I think this is just, you know, Trump political posturing, for his crowd.
Yeah, you know, I tend to think that's probably the more likely explanation, the sort of 3D kind of super strategic thing. That I don't really buy that. So yeah, I think that's true. But you know, one thing he mentioned, Donald Trump has mentioned a couple of times, and this is kind of caught on the right, especially, are the Guantanamo like conditions in the DC jail. And there are a lot of folks on the right are saying, oh, it's inhumane. In fact, back in October, 34 of these people being held in DC jail requested a transfer to Guantanamo Bay. I mean, okay, roll your eyes, you know. But and let me be clear that the DC jail is pretty bad. In November of 2021, after an extensive investigation, a federal investigation, 400 prisoners removed from the facility. The jail had issues for many, many years. Now, the DC mayor, in her 2022 budget, it allocates something like $250 million over 6 years to make improvements and build on to the jail and so forth. So, I mean, it's bad. there's no question it's bad, but I wonder how much of this is kind of like political posturing, because it seems to me that a lot of the, you know, a lot of folks on the right, when it's other folks being held, saying, you know, jail's supposed to be bad because we put bad people in there. What do you want to give them, club med sort of thing? I don't know. What do you make of this?
Well, again, part of that goes to who's being held and why. I think if you've got people who are you know, violent criminals need to be held there, right? There's certainly that the sympathy level sort of goes down. When you have folks who are nonviolent, I'm thinking of Peter Navarro, who, you know, taken away in leg irons for contempt of Congress. And put in the cell that held John Hinckley, that strikes me as overkill.
But isn't that's not really an issue with the jail. That's an issue with the judge.
Right. It's an issue with the federal government. But by extension, you know, the manner in which people are being held. So, look, I think our jail facilities should be fully funded so that they are humane. And you know that,
To me, it just
goes without saying. But
I was going to say, to me, it kind of reeks of hypocrisy because, of course, especially given that it's the D.C. jail, certainly Congress could very easily. I haven't seen any measures to, you know, build a fancy, fine, you know, state of the art sort of jail facility. I can just imagine how well that would go over. So to me, it's just a lot of political posturing, and you know, a lot of folks on the left say, "Oh, sure," when there are these, you know, poor black people who are held in a DC jail for a long time, for years, no one says anything. But all of a sudden, when it becomes some, you know, Trump supporters being held, well, there's this big investigation and oh my God, it's a scandal. And just goes to show you that when well-off white people are affected by something, it becomes much more of an issue than when poor black people are affected by it. And I think there's maybe something to that.
Maybe. Yeah. Again, look, if the conditions in the jail are not appropriate, if they do fall below constitutional norms, that would be investigated regardless of who's been incarcerated there or not, right? And whatever their color is. If this is an impetus that fixes that, great. Should it maybe have done earlier? Probably.
I don't think it would surprise anyone that when people who have more money, more resources, more power are affected by something, the government tends to take notice and act more quickly than when people without money, resources, and power are affected. That's just sort of how the world works, for better or not.
I think that's a fair observation. Yes.
So there you go. I'm being Captain Obvious here, I think, at this point. But all right. Well, on that note, before we actually end, we're kind of at that point. I want to do some recommendations. Jay, do you have anything for us this week for a recommendation?
So, you know, this was sort of following up on Thanksgiving last week, and I always recommend Mayflower, right?
Yep.
I've done that for a couple of times just because it's really cool. So, but what I did starting last year, I also went back and went to the original source material, which is William Bradford's of Plymouth Plantation. Bradford was the longtime governor of the Plymouth colony. And I got to tell you, it's a lot of fun. Again, if you're kind of geeky like me, because in some ways it's incredibly well written, even like by today's standard, or even by today's stylistic conventions, right? Mm-hmm. It's easy to read, and you say, "Well, there's this one line," and the Wall Street Journal cites this in an editorial every year before Thanksgiving about, you know, the pilgrims arrived. A line from Bradford about some are having gone. All of nature turned up a weather-beaten face to us. And that's just like, that's poetry, man. It's just, you know.
Nice.
Governors don't write like that anymore. there's also this part, which I think are unintentionally hilarious, just because of the style and the you know, these were very much God-fearing people. But there's this one anecdote about one of the strangers, right? Because the pilgrims came over. There was a bunch of pilgrims on the boat, but there were also a bunch of sort of seafaring guys who ran the boat and were along for the ride. And to our eyes would be sort of pirates, right? Mm-hmm. These were pretty rough characters. So he has a story about this one guy who had kept making fun of the pilgrims and give them a hard time over their religious beliefs and so forth. And there's this great passage where he says, and it came to pass that it pleased God to afflict him with a disease that caused him die slowly. And it was, there's this like, wonderful just sort of understatement of that. And I think I'm going to try to start work that in my conversation when stuff, bad stuff happens. Like, it pleased God to afflict him with us and such.
Let me know how that goes over. Yeah,
it was great. Yeah. So anyway, but anyway, what I'm saying is, if you are into history, it's really a fun read. And there's also a whole lot that goes on. There's much less about. I mean, Thanksgiving is barely mentioned. It gets like two lines, but there's much more mentioned about just the goings on between the people who were financing this expedition, and they were constantly mad about where's the money, and the whole thing is just a complete financial loss disaster. And they got this agent in London who's supposed to be helping them out, and he's really playing both sides and is terrible. And then they kick him out of the company, and anyway, there's a lot of that sort of, if you're interested in that deeper intrigue.
All right.
Plymouth Plantation.
And as always, Jay is our higher culture guy and our colonial sort of guy, and I am our lower culture guy. And so my recommendation will reflect this. I've been watching, my recommendation will be Tulsa King, Sylvester Stallone, his first TV series role. It's on Paramount Plus, and it is he plays a guy who just did a 25-year stint for not giving up his New York mob bosses. He was a capo there, and he ends up getting shipped up to Tulsa, where hilarity and violence ensue. He had a lot of time to read while he was in the joint, and there are some absolutely hilarious bits he'll talk about of philosophy and other things. And one point he talks about the value of a college education. It reminded me, it was probably the best short summary of my conversation with Brian Kaplan on the podcast about Kaplan's book about the value of education. And actually, I liked it so much, I'm going to play the clip for it right here now.
The whole point of a college degree is to show a potential employer that you showed up someplace 4 years in a row, completed a series of tasks reasonably well and on time. So if he hires you, there's a semi-decent chance that you'll show up there every day and not his business up.
So yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that. It's like it's a lot of fun. I am enjoying it thoroughly. Also, I should point out that it co-stars Andrea Savage, who is one of my favorite people. She was in the also very excellent show I'm Sorry, which was very sadly canceled after I think a couple of seasons, but Andrea Savage is wonderful. Sylvester Stallone is great. So Tulsa King, definitely a lot of fun and well worth watching is my recommendation. All right. So before we go, just a reminder, any sort of funding support we get for the rest of this year is going to go directly to help out Trey, and he's certainly earned every single cent of whatever folks might be interested in helping out with. And again, you can do that through all of our normal channels, and you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/politicsguys, and Venmo, we're at politicsguys, or through PayPal. And again, you can find all the support links in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And if you would like to get our midweek show, and we got a lot we're going to be talking about in our midweek show, including presidential emergency powers, which we touched on here, and some other stuff as well. we're happy to help you out. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you set up with access to our midweek show every week. And whether you're a supporter or not, it would really help us out if you can subscribe, rate and review us on whatever podcast app you're listening to it on, and share episodes on social media. And if you want to get in touch with us for any reason, you can do that at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you will find links in the show notes every single week. And finally, as always, a special thanks to our most excellent executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Moreno, Andre Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you join us.